Our second case is 20-21-831. Come forward, counsel. Tuscarora's County Public Defender Office versus Christy Gowdy. For the appellant, Mr. Moses.
Good morning. Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. The issue before the court is the interpretation of Section 119.12i. The court has emphasized that the non-prejudicial omission of a part of the administrative record is never grounds for automatic reversal under 119.12i, where there's a timely certification of the record. The trial court has absolute discretion to admit an omitted part of the record after 30 days where there is, after 30 days under the constitutional and statutory authority granted the court. There was no prejudice. It's clear that the public defender's office suffered no prejudice. Everyone, the trial court, and both parties had the entire transcript.
Okay, well, help me understand this, why there was no prejudice. I mean, there was a hearing set. It got pushed a number of months. That sounds like the public defender's office had to pay back pay. That sounds like prejudice to me.
The back pay is not a basis for prejudice.
Well, why not? I mean, because so someone has to spend more money than they would have. That seems like prejudice.
Your Honor, the back pay is a given.
The back pay may be a given, but the time that they're out of work is not a given.
The back pay is guaranteed risk, and pay is not. There's nothing additional paid.
Well, no, that's not true, right? I mean, if she's reinstated after 6 months, it's different than there's going to be more back pay than if she's not reinstated until after a year.
The back pay is guaranteed in the sense that it will be paid when she's reinstated.
But for the time that she's out of work and the longer it takes her to be reinstated, the more back pay is going to accrue. And that seems...
Yes, Your Honor, that's statutory. The risk of back pay is dependent upon the order of reinstatement being upheld. If it's not upheld, then the public defender's office doesn't pay anything.
Couldn't the public defender's office have sought a stay?
Yes.
And what would the effect of that have been?
It could have stayed the back pay, could have controlled the harm.
Well, how would a stay have, you made that argument in your brief, but a stay wouldn't have affected the amount of back pay. They still would have had to pay back pay during the time that she was gone.
Well, the trial court has discretion to control the docket, and if the trial court wants to hear the motion for judgment, it would necessarily push the briefing back. However, the trial court made a finding that there was no delay in the ultimate disposition of the appeal.
But I'm having a hard time understanding that. So I guess I need your help with that. There was a hearing set after the transcript wasn't filed. That hearing, that argument got moved. How is that not a delay?
It's a delay, but it's not prejudicial because it did not impede the public defender's ability to present its appeal.
Right. They only got to present it, but they had to wait longer to present it, which increased the risk of liability, right?
Your Honor, the back pay didn't impede the ability to present the appeal, and that was the key to establishing prejudice under Lawrence.
But why wouldn't the possibility that you have to pay more money be prejudicial? Because that's what delaying the our decision and increasing the amount of back pay would do.
It's a speculative harm that has no impact on the public defender's ability to present its appeal.
Couldn't you argue that Gowdy was prejudiced, not receiving pay during this period of time?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, the Court of Appeals did allude to the fact that both parties are prejudiced. However, the inherent delay is not itself grounds for prejudice. according to Lawrence, because it did not impede the appeal.
Well, that's the only thing that we look at, is the ability to present the appeal, not the consequence of the delay.
That's correct, Your Honor, yes. And I neglected to reserve time for rebuttal, Your Honor, 5 minutes, and then I'm sharing my time with Ms. Bry. The question of back pay, again, relies on the ultimate outcome. If the order of reinstatement is not upheld, then there's no obligation to pay any back pay. The question is not how much back pay accrues or how long the case takes. The question is, did the parties have the opportunity to present their appeal? And this was not impeded. There's no unimpeded opportunity to present the appeal. Therefore, no prejudice, and then the rule does not apply.
What would impair or impede the ability to present the appeal?
If the record had not been provided to the court allowed time for the supplementation of the missing day of transcript, and it had it February 6, 81 days before the originally scheduled argument on the merits. So the trial court and the parties had ample time to consider the full record. So the entire record was before all parties. So there was no delayed opportunity or impeded opportunity to brief the matter, to argue the matter.
So it's whether or not whether there's an ability to present the appeal at any time or not at all. Is that what we're looking at?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and because it was only moved, you say that did not impair the ability to present the appeal.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And it was moved for the supplementation of the record for the missing record.
That's correct, Your Honor. And then the argument on the motion for judgment was conducted approximately the same time as the originally scheduled hearing date on the merits. This time, Your Honor, I'd like to share the remainder of my opening argument with Ms. Bry.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court. The state admits that one of its agencies made a mistake here, but that mistake should not deprive Ms. Gowdy of her right to pursue her case. This court's precedent construing the statute doesn't require that result, and this court shouldn't impose it. We've talked somewhat about the Lorms case already. We think that case applies here and allows you to resolve this matter in a way that avoids the problem of reading the statute in such a way that would penalize a litigant for a non-party agency's failure to file a complete record, actions over which the litigant had no control. Usually we think of prejudice to one side as including a corresponding advantage to the opposing side, but here that's not the case. The board's inadvertent delay in filing the day of transcript of the record did not prejudice one party to the benefit of the other party. It didn't tilt the playing field in one direction or another. Both parties, to the extent the delay impacted them, it would have impacted both. Lorms and Arlo, this court's cases, require prejudice to a party's presentation of its case when part of the record is timely filed, as it was here. There's no
dispute.
Well,
then how do we get an agency to promptly file the record?
Well, Your Honor, again, this is an inadvertent thing. It was not something that
But if we agree with you, I mean, if I'm the agency, when I turn it in, I turn it in. Doesn't matter.
No, I think you're in most cases, and this case is a little bit unique in one sense. You have the State Personnel Board of Review, which is the adjudicating body. After the appeal is filed to Common Pleas Court, it really has no more role. The two adverse litigants are the employer and the employee. So putting an incentive in the way of having a case reversed on an entity that's not even a party to the case doesn't create the incentive that Your Honor is referring to here. So
in
this instance.
How would they care?
Well, it's their duty. I mean, they do have the duty to do that.
Of course, it's their duty. It was their duty in this case, too, and they didn't do it.
Understand, Your Honor. But again, when you look at some other situations where you have a licensing agency, for example, where somebody's denying a license, revoking a license, taking some action, and that agency or some part of it goes on as a party, an adverse party in the court appeal, then one can understand how this statute operates. When there's that adverse relationship, there's a benefit to one that isn't a benefit to the other. Here, whatever happened from the delay, there was no net prejudice to one side or the other. It affected both.
Counsel, wasn't there a recording of the hearing in the original filing?
Well, Your Honor, my understanding is there was a recording that is made of all of these hearings. I do not know that it was in the original filing. The original transcript and record filing on October 30th of 2019 included the first day of transcript and the first day of hearing, the last motions hearing, and all the exhibits. So it didn't include that, but my understanding is that the parties had access to that recording. So that was not something that was unavailable beforehand.
So upholding the fifth district here, it would be a ruling that if mistakes like this happen, the courts can never get to the merits, really, of the dispute. It would just be thrown out on a technicality.
Yes, Your Honor. In this factual situation, that's the concern. On the one hand, the Fifth District said that no prejudice was required in this case. We respectfully think that's incorrect in light of your decision in Lorms and Arlo. Since there's no dispute that part of the record was filed here, there would be prejudice required. And even if you look at, and we don't believe there was prejudice in the sense of what this court's decision in Lorms required to either party, but to the extent you look at what the Court of Appeals counted as prejudice, again, that affects both. It didn't tilt the playing field one way or the other. So we think by applying Lorms, you avoid the problem here, the potential problem of saying that somebody's right to pursue their cause of action just goes away because of something, not something that they did, but because of an inadvertent mistake in the nature of excusable neglect by the agency in this case. The Common Pleas Court, as my colleague mentioned, did find that the late filing would not alone have necessitated a delay in the overall disposition of the case, and in fact—
And so what was that based on?
Presumably based on the trial court's knowledge of its own caseload and what cases it had coming up and, you know, criminal matters that would have to take precedence and so on. I mean, it makes sense that the trial court would have the best understanding of that, and candidly, the employer has not really cast doubt on that finding by the trial court since it was decided within a year.
And the Court of Appeals disagreed with that. They said it was prejudice, presumably because they disagreed that since there would have been delay. How do we review that finding?
Well, you could measure it against other factors. For example, if the delay went on for 20 years, although legally you might say it's possible that the delay doesn't prejudice the presentation of the case. Nevertheless, I mean, you could have circumstances change in that period of time that it would have some prejudicial effects. I think looking just at the fact that the case got resolved within a year is something you could look at, and that is consistent with the court saying that it would not affect the disposition of the case. We think that, you know, prejudice would require something more concrete and not speculative and negative to the party's case, and particularly when you're talking one party's case.
Why wouldn't the possibility that a party would be subject to an increased back pay award be prejudicial? If you had to pay more, that seems like prejudice.
Well, again, that's Without getting too much into the back pay, which is goes into the merits of the case, but it's something whenever you have a public employer who is taking some kind of employment action, that's a decision they have to make of whether, you know, if it's upheld, it's upheld, but if it isn't upheld, there may be a reinstatement duty or a duty to pay back pay. But the bottom line is, if the trial court said, this isn't going to affect when my decision comes out, and he got his decision out within a year of when the case is filed, you're hard-pressed to say that the back pay was anything other than a potential and a speculative harm as opposed to a concrete harm.
Wouldn't the analysis of the employer be, okay, I've lost this round, I either keep them on the payroll, or if they're being disruptive or whatever reason they thought they had, I'm going to leave them out of the office, and I'm going to take my chances whether I have to pay back pay or not, knowing that if they kept them in the office, they'd still be paying what would be tantamount to back pay if they lost later, correct?
Well, that's one of the decisions an employer could make in that situation, right? In other words, to have the employee keep working until the appeal was completed, is that what you're suggesting?
Right,
so that's one possibility.
Either way, the employer would have to pay whether they kept them on or they didn't keep them on and they lost. The only way they would possibly gain is if they won on the appeal and had gambled and said, I'm going to keep them out of the office and not pay them. So is there prejudice there?
We don't think there's prejudice, especially in a case like this where you have a trial court that didn't think the delay in getting that second part of the record was going to affect his ultimate decision, and the case was decided within a year. But we
Counsel,
are just...
Counsel, if it was inadvertently not filed, and it's not a licensing board, your words... Why shouldn't we rule this as improvidently allowed case?
Because, Your Honor, we think this presents an important issue for the court to consider. How does the 119I statute, how does your Lorms decision, which we think you should follow here, apply in a situation where you have two adverse parties in a common pleas court appeal and an agency like the board that is not part of that appeal and is not adverse, it's their error that causes the harm, and therefore we would say that is not prejudice under the statute.
Well, if we have a Worms case, then why should we add another case?
Well, because this avoids the anomalous situation of saying that prejudice falls only on one party in an odd situation like this. Again, with the licensing agencies, you wouldn't have the same kind of incentive. And I see that I've used my time.
You're over your time, in fact.
Oh.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. My name is Scott DeHart. I'm with Zashin and Rich, and I'm joined this morning by my co-counsel, Drew Pearsall, and we represent the Tuscarawas County Public Defender. Your Honors, the linchpin of this case is a clear legislative command in the Ohio Administrative Procedure Act. Every day, there are state agencies making decisions that affect the lives not only of Ohioans, but of Ohio businesses, Ohio employers, and public employers like the public defender. Timely judicial review of those decisions is an important check on the authority of these state agencies. But the problem is that historically, these agencies were notorious, as the Hamilton County Common Pleas Court said in 1960, notorious for halfway filing their records if they filed them at all. So that's why 63 years ago, the General Assembly tackled that problem with a simple, straightforward solution. If the agency doesn't file the complete record on time, then the court must enter judgment for the party appealing the agency's order. Now, that solution has worked, and what was once a notorious problem in administrative law is now the exception, not the rule.
So the way you read that provision of the statute leaves no room for error. One page missing renders it incomplete.
Justice Stewart, that's the language that the General Assembly chose. A complete record must be filed, and decisions from this state, I believe the Checkered decision from the 10th District had even identified complete record of proceedings to mean a complete, everything from A to Z, from beginning of end to the case.
And if that doesn't happen, then there is no wiggle room for anything. There's no weighing or balancing of interest. There's no evaluation of prejudice. There's regardless of even if that one page missing comes in the next day. You're saying there's no wiggle room.
Yes, Justice Stewart, that's the way the statute reads. Now, I'm aware, and we've addressed at length in our merit briefing, that following the enactment of the statute and beginning with the 10th District's decision in Checker in 1974, the courts began to add a prejudice requirement on read into the words party adversely affected.
If we interpreted the statute the way you suggested originally, that it's just absolute, black and white. Wouldn't that create an equal protection or a due process problem in some cases? If we grant parties the right to appeal, but we say that some parties can be arbitrarily deprived of that right through no fault of their own, just because some bureaucrat messed up, doesn't that seem arbitrary, capricious? Doesn't it seem like aren't there problems with that?
It's an important point, Justice DeWine, and we addressed this at some points in our briefing. The due process argument that was raised here was the main constitutional infirmity that was brought up by Ms. Gowdy and by the Amici. And that argument rests on the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in the Loudermill versus Board of Education case, which requires only two things. A public employer, before terminating an employee, has to give a pre-deprivation notice and opportunity hearing, and Ms. Gowdy received that. And a post-deprivation evidentiary hearing, and Ms. Gowdy received that.
But hasn't the U.S. Supreme Court also said that if you're going to grant parties a right to appeal, you cannot arbitrarily deprive some parties of the right to appeal? I mean, you don't have to grant a right to appeal at all, but once you do that, you have to have procedures that comport with due process and equal protection, right?
That's correct, but what this court has said is that the General Assembly, because there is no inherent right to those appeals, the General Assembly can create them and can fashion the procedural requirements, and if they're not met, then the appeal can be tossed on that basis. We cited some cases at page 49 of our merit brief just for that general proposition that the General Assembly gets to define what those procedures are. And I would point out there's a case, the Lipscomb versus London Correctional Institute case. We discuss at page 29 of the merit brief. That's a 10th District case. This is the same district that created the prejudice requirement. And they address the constitutionality of this record filing scheme as applied to SPBR. This was about a year, maybe 2 years, I can't recall, after the 1992 amendment from the General Assembly that carved out a special rule for SPBR. SPBR is the only agency in the state that there's a requirement in Chapter 11912 to pay a monetary deposit to SPBR to transcribe the record. And if the appealing party doesn't do that, then SPBR, under the statute, is relieved from its obligation to transcribe the record, and the harsh penalty, as some courts have characterized it, of this statute can't be applied. But it follows that if the deposit is timely paid, which the public defender did in this case, then the penalty does apply to SBBR. But in that Lipscomb case, the 10th District considered whether there was a constitutional infirmity in this process of requiring litigants to pay the deposit to SPBR, having SPBR transcribe and file a record, and the court found there that that requirement was not jurisdictional, and thus there was no constitutional infirmity in it. So our position is that Ms. Gowdy got all the process that she was due. If there was any deprivation of due process here on some procedural basis, then it was not by the public defender's office, it was by the State Personnel Board of Review. If Ms. Gowdy's seeking a remedy, her remedy would be to seek it from SPBR. She could pursue a 42 U.S.C. 1983 action. She could also go take up the cause with the General Assembly. This law has been on the books for 63 years because it works.
Well, that's not going to do anything for her job or back pay.
I agree, Chief Justice O'Connor, and the Fifth District was mindful of that in the penultimate paragraph, I believe, of their decision. They recognized it had been, I believe, brought into the oral arguments at the Fifth District that the public defender had reinstated Ms. Gowdy during the pendency of the Fifth District appeal. And so the Fifth District, recognizing that, stated in their opinion, we understand that this means the end of Christy Gowdy's employment, and we're mindful of that, but we are compelled to follow the language of the statute that the General Assembly enacted.
So if we get to prejudice, which seems to be the law anyway, we have the trial court finding that there is no prejudice. So how do you get around that?
It's an important point, Justice DeWine, and we get around it because we don't believe it's correct, and because the trial court didn't support that finding. It's a cursory sort of one-off remark in the context of this of Judge O'Farrell's decision in the Common Pleas Court, saying, well, you know, the hearing dates were moved, and the disposition of the case was moved. There's a three-month delay that's readily apparent on the docket, and yet we find there was no delay. But the judge didn't
explain.
So you
have the trial judge, who presumably knows its docket, knows what's, when it's going to decide what, who says there's no prejudice. I guess that's a factual finding. And then you have the appellate court that doesn't have the familiarity with the trial court's docket, who just says, no, that's not true. I mean, why? There's really no evidentiary, you know, there's not much basis for that in the Court of Appeals decision either. So why shouldn't we just credit what the trial court says?
Well, Your Honor, we think that this is a question of law that the appeals court could consider de novo.
How's that question of law, though? I mean, whether or not something is going to cause delay seems like a question of fact.
I would tend to agree, and I think in my mind it's at least a mixed question, though, because the legal standard of whether prejudice exists in that situation or not is a question of law, and it's based on the interpretation of this court's controlling decisions in Lorms and Arlo.
But doesn't it come down to a pretty simple question? Would the court have decided this case at the same time if it didn't have to move the hearing? That seems like a factual question, right?
I do think it comes down to that, but I think that the finding of the trial court can't be credited because the docket itself speaks for itself. The hearing on the merits of our appeal was supposed to be heard, I believe, April 24th or 27th of 2020. In fact, it was heard in August. There's a four-month gap. One of those months was because of the criminal docket of the court, but the other three were because of the necessity to remedy SPBR's failure to certify the record, address it in briefing and oral argument, and get a ruling from the court, which, in fact, the ruling on the public defender's motion for judgment was issued the same day that we were supposed to have the merits hearing. So, you know, we are aware of the Common Pleas Court's finding that there was no prejudice, but we find no basis in the record to credit that, and we think that even if it's reviewed with a higher standard of abuse of discretion, or that it's arbitrary or capricious or unreasonable, we don't think that that factual finding or legal determination should be credited, and we think the Fifth District got it right on that point.
So let me, looking at this in the context of 119 and 119.12i is within the confines of 119.01 to 119.13. And so within all that, the ramifications of what you're suggesting would mean that if there's an objection made to the renewal of a liquor permit by a city, or if there's the Division of Liquor Control finds or believes that there's a violation against a liquor permit holder, this is adjudicated before the Ohio Liquor Control Commission. So essentially then, if the Ohio Liquor Control Commission failed to file a full record before the Common Pleas Court, then essentially the appeal goes away under your interpretation. Is there any difference between what's happening here with the Personnel Board of Review? I know it's in 124, but it seems to me that when we're applying 119.12i, it would apply to all these other agencies addressed by 119. Am I correct, or can you help me there?
Yes, Justice Brunner, you are correct, and I believe I'll credit where it's due that in the reply brief of the appellant, they identified the various other state agencies whose adjudications are subject to 119.12 review. SPBR decisions are reviewed because Chapter 124.34 points you to 119.12. There is a distinction, I think, between SPBR's decisions and the adjudications of some of these other agencies in the sense that other agencies, licensing boards, et cetera, decide matters in the first instance, whereas SPBR is reviewing the decision of appointing authorities. So appointing authorities conduct a predisciplinary hearing, they make a disciplinary determination, and then the State Personnel Board of Review exercises significant control to modify, affirm, or disaffirm those decisions. And so I do think there is a distinction, and that's part of the reason why the statute, while applying this penalty to SPBR equally like every other agency, it also has a couple carve-outs for SPBR. If you look at, I believe it's 119.12b, SPBR appeals go to the county of the appointing authority rather than just to Franklin County.
Sure, but I don't think the venue's an issue, but still, whether it's a Division of Water hearing for a violation at Department of Natural Resources or whether it's a Liquor Commission hearing regarding charges brought by or objections filed by a city or charges brought by the Division of Liquor Control, how is that any different from an in-agency hearing where the person gets their due process, they may be represented by their union, if there's a union there, and then the agency makes the decision, just like it would at Natural Resources. How is that any different? Because what do you see what I'm saying?
I don't think it is necessarily different, although, as I said, SPBR's role is adjudicating over a prior decision.
Well, and so just like the Liquor Commission would be, well, okay, so you're saying the SPBR would be pretty much at the same level that the Common Pleas Court would be for some of these other appeals, correct?
Yeah. Correct. SPBR is the finder of fact, and the record that it creates is the only record that the Common Pleas Court can consider when determining is there reliable, probative, and substantial evidence. And that's one of the problems in this case, that, and that's one of the problems that the General Assembly tackled in 1959, was if those, Justice O'Donnelly, you mentioned in the earlier argument that because of this procedural technicality, the parties may never get to the merits. But the flip side of that coin is the Loom Lodge case that we discussed in our brief, where if the record isn't filed, then the court can't adjudicate the merits either.
So how is that different from the Liquor Commission, though? The Liquor Commission acts at this in the same role as PBR, and if you think of the ramifications of a city filing an objection to the renewal of a liquor permit because of what they perceive to be a problem for the neighborhood, so by some technical problem, everybody's out of luck, the appeal's done?
That is the solution that the General Assembly designed in 1959, because to Justice Fisher's point in the earlier argument, how else do you hold agencies accountable to perform this duty when they get to do their adjudication, file their record, and check out because it's between the litigants from there on after? And that's the solution they came up with in 1959, and the General Assembly has revisited Chapter 119.12 with various enactments, but has changed nothing about this statute except to lengthen the time periods a little bit. So it used to be 20 and 10, now it's 30 days and 30 days.
What about due process? I mean, can't we still consider that? Because that's a constitutional issue, and we're not just bound by what's in the legislation if there's a constitutional problem.
I agree, Your Honor. I will say that this statute's been considered by this court in Maytash, Lorms, and Arlo. It's been considered by a good majority, at least, of the courts of appeal of this state. In 63 years, it's never been held to be unconstitutional, and the 10th District in Lipscomb, in fact, upheld this scheme as having no constitutional infirmity. And I see that my time has expired. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Counsel, your time's expired. You may take a minute.
We're asking the court to apply its decision in Lorms and reverse the decision of the Fifth District. The merit and fitness provisions make it clear that it would be an absurdity to apply 119.12i in a fashion to penalize a non-party, due to a non-party agency clerical error, penalize the employee the same as if the employer were on the other side. They'd have to take back a bad employee or the Liquor Commission, they would have to grant a license that didn't deserve to be granted. A host of agencies would be affected, and it would disrupt the administrative law process. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, we call a recess.
All rise.